Welcome to the first ever Ohio Paranormal Convention. My name is James Bell. I'm the founder of Southern Ohio Paranormal Research. We're the one that's hosting this. And like I said, it's the first time ever. I want to give huge props to Brian Klein. He is my co-founder. He pretty much 100% put this together. He was amazing. He contacted everybody. Everybody was able to work with us, and all of our profits, minus what the cost of Hera, goes to the Ohio Historical Society. So thank you for coming out and joining us, and we have a good time. Brian, it's up to you.
Up to me?
Up to you.
It is up to me now.
No. That's it.
All right. As James said, thank you very much for coming out. Obviously, I'm a little nervous because we have 15 speakers. We have 12 vendors, and I had received, I had received a lot of support from the community. All of our guests here are out in support for the community. And as James said as well, all of our proceeds are going to the Ohio Historical Society once we pay for our venue. We are making no money off of this event. We want to make sure that Ohio's historical treasures are preserved. So it's actually going directly to the Historical Preservation Office of the Ohio Historical Society. We hope to have this as an annual thing here at Hera Arena as long as they keep inviting us. Thanks to Hera Arena, and thanks to all of our guests who will be speaking this weekend. We hope you've had a chance to meet with most of them in the vendor area. Please make sure that you walk through the entire vendor area. We have guests and vendors mixed together. We have four rows of vendors and rows against the wall. Some great vendors like Patu Designs, Alternative Measures, Dream Airlines. We also have Theodora. We have Miss Margo, who's a bone reader. We have a Mid Angels, which does auric photos and stone and rune readings. All of our guests have tables as well, so if you want to see any books that they've authored, please feel free to take a look at there. Ask them any questions. I'm sure they'll be glad to provide you with any information that they have. Before we go on, I do want to say that John Kachuba is going to be coming up at 10:45, and after him, Bill Scott. Both are, going to be talking about something completely different. Bill Scott's going to be talking about Haunted Kentucky, Spirits of the Bluegrass, whereas John Kachuba is going to be talking about Ohio's famous haunts. Really looking forward to seeing both of those speakers. But before we start everything, we are going to have a raffle. We have a huge amount of items that have been donated, either from Shadowlands Ghost Hunter Store, who donated a DVR, 4-channel DVR system. Basically, all you need to do is add a hard drive. But we have a bunch of books. First one is More Haunted Hoosier Trails by Wanda Lou Willis. We have an autographed copy of Ghost Hunting Ohio by John Kachuba. We have two copies of True Ghost Stories from Ohio, Volume 2, our friends at Dark Figure Productions. There's an autographed copy of Weird Ohio by James A. Willis. We have two free medium Cassano pizza coupons. Cassano's is a local pizza place here in Dayton. They were gracious enough to donate two free coupons. We have a book on Reiki. There are five past issues of Fate magazine that we're giving away. We also have five Dayton Gems hockey t-shirts that we're giving away. The Dayton Gems have just recently returned to Dayton, and they're going to be playing hockey here in Hare Arena, so they were gracious enough to give us some t-shirts. Patu Designs gave us a key ring of dichroic glass. We'll be giving that away, and as I said, the DVR, 4-channel DVR. All of them except for the DVR are $1 for ticket, six for $5. The DVR is $5 a ticket. So before everyone gets up to speak, if you want to put your ticket in, feel free to step over to the table and we'll get you set up with that. I do also want to thank our members that are helping out today. We have Chris Vermillion, he's from our Columbus team, and Greg Flanagan, who is from our Dayton team. They're doing an awesome job just welcoming people at the door and meeting everyone. So if you have any questions, just make sure you look for someone in an orange badge. We'll be happy to help you out. So with that being said, I'm done.
When are you going to do the raffle?
Oh, the DVR will be given away Sunday. And you have to be present to win. We want to give as many people as possible a chance to put in for that. The other items we'll be giving away throughout today and tomorrow. And they'll be just, we're going to pick one at random. Okay, we're going to be drawing for the John Kachuba book or Weird Ohio. So we're doing a lot of giveaways, so you have a lot of chances to win some great items. So let's see what time it is.
10:30.
So yeah, we got about 15 minutes before John Kachuba comes up. So if anyone would like to do the raffle, feel free to go over to the table and we'll get you taken care of.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, so we'll get this show on the road here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow. My name is John Kachuba. I live in Cincinnati. I'm a paranormal investigator and writer. And what I'm going to be doing today is talking about haunted locations in Ohio. So rather than talking about techniques and how you do things and all that, I'm simply going to give you all kind of a little bit of a road tour of some of what I consider to be Ohio's, you know, nice hot spots for ghost hunting. I hope to talk about half an hour or so and then leave it open for some questions and all, because I like people to, if they have questions, to be able to get them out and talk about that. So about a quarter after 11, I will shut up if I don't shut up before then. And actually, if I start running over, somebody out there with a watch can yell at me and say, hey, it's quarter after 11, shut up. And that'll be fine. I'll be very happy to hear that. So. Most of what I'm going to talk to you today about are sites that are taken from two of my books, Ghost Hunting Ohio and Ghost Hunters. Ghost Hunting Ohio is actually my first ghost hunting book. It was written in 2004, and Ghost Hunters came out in 2007. Ghost Hunters is national in scope, but there's a little bit of Ohio in there as well, whereas obviously Ohio is completely Ohio. So that's where I'm getting this information that we're talking about. And to sort of start things off, since we're in Dayton, I want to talk about some local places first. Yes, I do. There, okay. Anybody go to the Amber Rose restaurant? Has anybody? One person? Two people, okay. Has anybody eaten at the Amber Rose restaurant? Yes. Okay, great. Great food.
Good Polish food.
Exactly, good Polish food. The Amber Rose has been around for a long time, and it originally started off as a sort of general store. And it was owned by a guy named Zygmunt, and I'm gonna mess up, despite the fact that my name is Kachuba, I'm gonna mess up his last name. But it's like Skopolowski, roughly. It's spelled that way. Zygmunt had a general store, and they used to live up top, which was typical in days like that, and the store was down below. He had a daughter they nicknamed Chicky, and she was the youngest of his children. Chicky never married. She stayed home, she tended to the family business. And in fact, she lived upstairs by herself after the family passed away. She was the last one there, and she lived upstairs and passed away at that home at a ripe old age. It is now a restaurant. And the restaurant has used the bottom level as its serving area, but they've also gone upstairs. So Chicky's former bedroom is now a small dining room as well. So you can imagine you're eating in Chicky's bedroom. The downstairs is very interesting. They still have some of the old appliances and counters from the general store. They've got this huge scale that they used to weigh, I don't know what, I don't know, bags of stuff, barrels of stuff, I don't know. And the Skopolowski name is engraved on this scale. You can still go there and weigh yourself if you want before the meal and after the meal. You know, it's kind of a nice gimmick. But the people that work at the restaurant say that Chicky, who lived there basically her whole life, is still there. And I talked to a lot of the wait staff there and the servers, and I had a great Eastern European meal there. If you like German, Russian, whatever, this is the place to go. There's a lot of things that happened. One of the servers said that she had gone down to the basement, which is basically their storeroom. And you know, for institutional use, mayonnaise and salad dressings come in like 85-gallon drums, you know? And they put them on shelves. And she said she was downstairs and these were lined up on a shelf and that one fell off. And I said, so big deal, one fell off. I mean, that's what's so odd about that? If you have it unbalanced or something, it's going to happen. She said, well, I don't mean fell off as much as floated off and then flew to the floor, which is a little bit different than falling off. So that kind of upset her a little bit to think that something like that was going on. Her husband also works in the restaurant. He was a chef. He said one night he was working in the kitchen, and they have a small kitchen upstairs and a main one downstairs. He was working in the upstairs kitchen, and he noticed out of the corner of his eye, he saw kind of a glow, and he turned, and he said he saw basically a ball of blue light just floating in the air about 10 feet away from him. And it just disappeared. He had no idea what it was. But there were no windows that could have had like any kind of reflection. There wasn't any. You can see where this place is. It's in a residential area. So there's like no neon lights outside or anything else like that that would have made some kind of a blue image. It was just this blue ball of light. He said it was kind of a glowing, flashing ball, and it disappeared. So you've had those kinds of things going on there. And you know, things get moved around all the time. They'll set up a table with place settings for a party that's being reserved or something like that. They'll turn around 5 minutes later and everything is moved around. You know, the typical things that you hear in restaurants. Restaurant ghosts love to mess around with place settings. I don't know why you do. But it's a very interesting place. And the nice thing about it is, unlike so many hauntings where people are afraid, you know, of what's going on, the people at the Amber Rose, the wait staff, they love it. They say, you know, Chickie is here. She loves this place. She was here in life. She's still here. She's watching out for us. Yeah, she's a prankster. Yeah, she's a little bit of pain in the butt. You know, this is Chickie's house and we respect that. So I kind of like that attitude. But that's Dayton. That's nearby. Woodlawn Cemetery. Has anyone been out to Woodlawn? Okay, Woodlawn? Oh, so it's not Lawn, it's L-A-N-D?
Yeah.
Ah, this is a different place. This is different, okay. Woodland Cemetery. Lawn, land, I mean, come on. This is a very interesting place, very historic. The Wright brothers are buried there. Paul Laurence Dunbar, the famous African-American poet, is buried there. Irma Bombeck, you know, the humorist, is buried there. The interesting thing about Irma Bombeck's stone is that it's literally a stone. It's a big rock, and there's no inscription on it, no name, nothing. It's just this rock. And if you don't know it's Irma Bombeck's grave, you know, you wouldn't know it's Irma Bombeck's grave. It's a big rock. But this is probably the most interesting monument in there, and it's the grave of a boy named Johnny Morehouse. And back in the day, back in the mid-19th century, as you probably know, Dayton, Cincinnati, a lot of major cities in Ohio were canal towns. You know, there was literally thousands of miles of canals all across Ohio. That's how commerce, you know, went from one place to another. Dayton was a big place, big canal city. Johnny Morehouse in 1860 was a five-year-old boy who was playing by one of the canals, and he fell into the canal. He was with his dog. Johnny was 5 years old, couldn't swim. He fell into the canal. And the story is that his faithful dog jumped in immediately after him to try. You know, whether the dog was trying to rescue him or just following his master, I don't know. But in any case, both the boy and the dog drowned. Kind of a tragic story. But Johnny Morehouse was buried in Woodland Cemetery. And this is his monument. And you know, it's hard to make it out, but the dog actually has his paw, his leg, and his paw over the form of the boy as if he's like really protecting him. And people go to the cemetery and they give little presents to Johnny, you know. He's actually, it's hard to tell on this thing, but he's actually wearing a knit cap, the boy. His head is right here. And this is not stone. Somebody put a knit cap over him to keep him warm, I guess, at night, you know. This photo I took around Easter. So you notice people brought little Easter baskets and bunnies. And the reason why they do that, because people say that Johnny is still there, that they have seen the vision of a little boy and a dog sort of walking around at night there. So people believe that Johnny Morehouse is still there. In addition to that, there's been sightings of a woman in, well, actually not in white. It's very odd because she appears in sort of modern contemporary dress. She's been seen several times in the same place at a particular gravestone crying. She's literally sitting near it and she's weeping. And she's a young girl, she's in her 20s. She's wearing, the description says she's wearing jeans, like a red top and a blue sweater, like, you know, tied around the waist. So it's a very specific description. And people that have seen her, and some people have, keep saying that they have that same description of her. And they always see her in sort of the same position, the same stone, weeping all the time. So nobody knows exactly yet who that is. And as far as I know, no investigators have put any kind of history together on that. But it seems modern, it seems contemporary. You know, jeans and a sweater wrapped around your waist, that's a very sort of contemporary style. So there's a couple of things happening here at Woodland. One of my favorite places in Dayton is the United States Air Force Museum up at Wright Pat, at Wright Patterson Air Force Base. If you haven't been there, it's just a great museum to go to just to see all the aircraft. And, you know, this museum starts off with the old biplanes and takes you all the way through to modern rockets and missiles out in the yard out behind the museum. So it's a fantastic look at aviation history. But it's also, according to a lot of people, full of spirits that come with this aircraft. There's a theory that some people say that ghosts or spirits can attach themselves to things, to inanimate objects, things of value, things of sentimental attachment, or if you think of military, perhaps where combat veterans went through some pretty horrific things. One of the exhibits there is a piece of wreckage, a piece of a fuselage from a B-24 bomber called Lady Be Good that went down in the Libyan desert in Africa during World War II. Interesting story about this is, people went out to fight as survivors. They found six guys dead in the crash site. Then they found another guy dead, but he was 179 miles away from the crash site. He had somehow walked in a Libyan desert after a crash 179 miles. They have no idea how this happened. It's not paranormal, it's just incredible that this happened. And they found his body. But then the interesting thing is they also found, in addition to that, they found a set of footprints that were leading off into the desert. And they tracked them for several miles into the sand, then they just stopped. And they fan out and everything else looking for him. They couldn't find it. You have this one track of footprints just going out into the middle desert, and then what happens to the guy? What, he sprout wings and fly away? They don't know. They never found him. They don't know anything about it. So he's like a missing crewman. The interesting thing here is that in the museum, on the Lady Be Good, all they have is, like I said, just this piece of fuselage, and it's mounted on the wall, and there's a story about these guys in Libya. But there is also a full B-24 bomber intact at the museum, and it's called the Strawberry Bitch. And what they say is that you will see crew people from the B-24 actually around this, that people have seen people working on this plane, walking around it, when there's nothing like that going on. The museum does have, as you see in this picture, and I'll get to this in a second, there are mannequins that are, set up as tableaus, but they don't move. They're just silent. With the B-24, there are no mannequins at all, and yet people see these figures walking around the plane. People say that it's right next to the Lady Be Good wreckage. And people think that it's the crewmen from the Lady Be Good who are sort of thinking, hey, B-24, this is our B-24. And that they think they're there, which is kind of interesting. This one I like. It's hard to see it, but this is a railroad boxcar back here. This guy in the foreground is actually wearing a German military uniform. What's happened in this scene is the guys in the train are, you can tell they're airmen, they've got the Air Force jackets and all this. They're captured airmen, they're Allied airmen that were shot down. They're on a train that's going to transport them to a German POW camp. You can see the guy in the foreground here, basically he's just getting ready to go on the train. His buddies are going to help him on. The interesting thing with this picture is that this is an actual train car. This was a real train car that was used by the Germans to transport POWs to camps. They used to paint right across the roof in huge letters, POW. So as Allied planes were coming over, they would say, protect the, you wouldn't bomb that train. Now, whether it was actually transporting POWs or whether the Germans were being cagey and transporting something else in there, you never knew. But they would do that at the top of the roof. This picture has really, really hard to see. But up here, and actually a larger one, right here, very hard to see in this picture, are some orbs. Now, orbs are very controversial. And what an orb is you take a picture of something, to the naked eye, everything looks fine. I take a picture of this room, I see all you sitting here. Then when I run that shot either through a camera, through a computer, or if it was old film, I had it printed, I would get little sort of globes of light. They call them orbs. Probably 90% of those can be explained away, if not more, by some glitch in the camera, something in the atmosphere, whatever. There's a very small percentage that you really can't understand what they are or explain them away logically. Some people think that's energy, and that it's energy caused spirit energy, that it's a spirit that is there. Well, the interesting thing about this picture is I took three pictures in sequence. And the first picture came out with, like I said, these little orbs here. The second picture, which was taken, you know, a fraction of a second later, and I don't have that one here, but there's like a mist that suddenly appears like right across the center like this. And the third picture, again, a fraction of a second later, is totally clear. No mist, no orbs, no nothing. So within like, you know, a second or a second and a half, we went from these little orbs to a mist to nothing. And that's what caught my attention. Not so much just that I had these orbs, but that in the sequence of three pictures, I had two different kinds of anomalies in the photo and then suddenly clear. And this is indoors, you know, under fine conditions. I mean, there wasn't any weather condition that's going to cause a cloud or vapor or anything else like that. This is a totally dry, climate-controlled area. It's a hangar. So that was kind of surprising to me. There are other aircraft in the museum as well that I could talk about at length, but I won't, that people will say they see a pilot, you know, sitting, there's a helicopter from Vietnam. People continually see a guy working the controls in it. Of course, there's nobody there. So there's a lot of this kinds of thing. And it makes sense, again, if you think that a spirit could be attached to where it was a horrific event. I mean, a lot of these guys obviously lost their lives in the aircraft, you know, during different wars. By the way, the people at the museum were less than forthcoming about almost anything I asked them. I'd ask a question, and of course I told them I was writing a book and I'm interested about some of the paranormal aspects. And they handed me this form. They said, well, you have to fill out this official request, which went to Washington, D.C. And of course I filled it out in 2003. Haven't heard from them yet. Things are slow in Washington, I understand. So moving down south a little bit to Cincinnati. This is the Cincinnati Art Museum. And, you know, it's interesting. I find that places like art museums or performance centers, like music halls, which I have one here, that frequently you find theaters, frequently you find hauntings there. And I think the reason for that partly is, again, because of all the sort of energy that's generated in places like this. We think of the creative energy, the creative process, or for that matter, religious places. I'm amazed at how many ghosts are in churches and temples and places like that. But again, if you think about a bunch of people getting together in prayer or meditation, you think of all that energy, it makes sense that some of that might be still hanging around and may in some way be spirit energy. The Cincinnati Art Museum has a couple of different ghosts. And I have to say, I'm not sure how authentic some of them are. For instance, the Egyptian mummy that people see walking around, I'm not sure about that. The museum does indeed have Egyptian mummies. They have some beautiful sarcophagi and they have some mummies. They've got two or three mummies, I think. Security guards have told me that they have seen in that area that they have seen the mummy. So, okay. Well, I didn't see the mummy, but they say they saw the mummy. But there is an interesting one that more people have seen, which is up on the second floor, I think it is, there's a medieval section. And there's one little room built off, and it's a replica of like a 12th century Spanish chapel. It's a replica. However, what is authentic are the murals that are inside this chapel. They were actually taken from a Spanish chapel in Spain, 12th century, and they're simply put on the walls here. So it's like you're walking into one of these chapels. So although you're walking around actual modern walls, you're surrounded by 12th century tapestries from a chapel, from a religious place. And I talked to a few different security guards who have told me about seeing a monk, as they describe it, in that area. I talked to one guard who said she was up making the rounds at night, the museum was closed, and she just kind of turned around for whatever reason, and she saw behind her in the archway that was going into this chapel, she said, I saw this black figure. It was like a black hooded figure. She said, I can only think of it as like a monk. And she said, it just stood there. And I said, what did you do? She said, well, I just stood there looking at it. And she said, as I watched it, she said, it started to rise, and it just lifted up and disappeared through the ceiling. Okay, so I said, what'd you do at that point? And she said, well, I took a couple of days off and came back. But it's interesting. There's also a tomb cover, a modern one, of a woman named Lizzie Duvenick. Lizzie Duvenick was married to Ed Duvenick, who was a famous artist from Covington, Kentucky, and was one of the art directors at the museum around late, early 1900s, I guess. Long story short is that Lizzie died in Italy after they were married for only about a year or so. And Lizzie was a burgeoning artist in her own right. Frank Duveneck, who was a painter, at his wife's death, turned to sculpture, and he made this beautiful cover for her tomb in Florence, Italy. And it's literally Lizzie, full size, lying on her back, head under a pillow, her hair braided, hands crossed, so like this beautiful, beautiful statue carved, and a long like palm branch across her body. It's gorgeous. What the museum has, since she was buried in Florence, Italy, and that's where the tomb is, the museum has Frank Duveneck's original plaster cast of that statue. And it's on a big sort of stone pedestal, so it looks like a tombstone. And again, talking to some of the volunteers there, some of the security people, they'll swear that they have seen Lizzie actually above that, like literally floating above that tomb there. Duveneck came back from Italy and became the director of the Cincinnati Art Museum for many, many years. It kind of makes sense that Lizzie wanted to be with them and that she's back at a place that they both love. So that's pretty interesting. This is something a little bit modern from the museum, and it's a little bit hard to tell. A friend of mine named Shane Watkins in Cincinnati, who has a paranormal investigative group, was at the museum. And he was in, if you haven't been there, it's sort of like an atrium. And you can look up and it's like a gallery all around. It's in the center of the museum. This was broad daylight. I mean, it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he took a picture. He took a picture looking up, and you can sort of make out something here. It looks something like a person. When he got that picture, he was surprised because there wasn't anybody standing up there. And he took some other photos, which I don't bother to have up here, but he actually then placed himself up there, placed other people up there, and took a picture from the same position down below to see how it would look. And a person standing there really comes out very clearly, very well defined. You know it's a person. This is odd. I mean, it's not quite, it's sort of a human figure, but not quite. And there's nothing else back there. There's no door back there. There wasn't anything standing there, any kind of a display or anything else like that. There was nothing up there. So he wants to go back and do some more work at the observatory. And I think it's the art museum. And it's probably worth it. This is something brand new. The Cincinnati Observatory, has anybody been down to the Cincinnati Observatory at all? Any astronomers? Have you been there? It's great, it's a beautiful place. A quick little bit of history. In 1845, Cincinnati built the first public public observatory in the United States. John Quincy Adams laid the cornerstone for the building. And that's how old this is. They have a telescope in there, it's 163 years old. It's huge, built of mahogany and brass. It's gorgeous, and it still works. They still use it to look at planets and stars. It's incredible. This building, this is a new location for the observatory. This building was built in 1873. They moved up from downtown Cincinnati. It was starting to get a little smoky and charcoal burning fireplaces and things like that, to a higher location in 1873. And this is the observatory now. In 1943, an astronomer that was in there, his son was in World War II, serving the Pacific. And as far as you know, he was missing in action. He got a word back that your son is missing. We haven't found him, we don't know. We're telling you he's missing in action. At the same time, the astronomer was going through some personal problems of his own, also bad health. So one day, he went into the main observatory room here where they have this huge telescope. And they have these tall ladders that they use to get up higher to the eyepiece and to adjust things. He went up one of the tall ladders with a rope, put the rope around one of the gear mechanisms of the telescope, put the other end around his neck, stepped off the ladder. This was 1943, and at first I heard it, I said, yeah, sure. But then I found that there was an obituary in the New York Times of this guy, and there was a short piece in the Cincinnati newspaper in 1943 that said he was a suicide in the observatory. So, very odd. Shane Watkins, the person whose photo you saw in the art museum, and myself, we did an investigation in here one night. And it was pretty incredible. It was in the middle of February, very cold, and you don't heat these buildings because it affects the telescope, so it's cold inside as well. But we recorded a variety of EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, which are very interesting. Sound like a human voice, like a male voice. So we got some of that. We got some replies to questions and, you know, knocking in response to different kinds of things. So we think there's something there, and we'd like to do another full bore investigation to see what else is up there. This whole thing was triggered by the fact that the observatory historian gives tours there routinely. And in one tour, there was a woman who, when she came out of that observatory area, the dome, said to the guy, his name is John Ventry, she said to him, "Is there a ghost in this building?" He said, "Why do you say that?" It's like, "I sense the presence of something up there." Now, he knew about the suicide, but he never knew anything about a ghost. He never had any experiences. But yet this woman had some sensation of that. So this was last year. I was on Coast to Coast AM last year, and John heard the radio broadcast. And so he called me and said, "You want to come out and do an investigation? I think I have something here." So that's how that started. And I'm still working with them because we'd like to find out what's going on. Okay, so I said creative places. Cincinnati Music Hall. This place, if you haven't been down there, I suggest you go down there just to see a hear a concert or whatever. It's a beautiful place. It was built in 1873, and it was built on the site of what was the Cincinnati Orphanage. Prior to the Cincinnati Orphanage, it was Cincinnati Hospital and Pest House, which was where they put people who were contagious and usually indigent and, you know, derelict or whatever, not people who could pay for good medical care. They put them in there. And it was also a potter's field on that site as well. So you can imagine when you're digging a foundation for a building like this on a site of what used to be a mental hospital, an orphanage, a pest house, and a potter's field, that you're going to be disturbing some things. And I want to read you something, if I can, if you'll indulge me here, from Ghost Hunting Ohio, because this is a great description. I love this. When this was being built, it said that actually the construction began in 1873. In 1876, the journalist Lafcadio Hearn, who's a famous journalist, was writing for the Cincinnati Observer, it was called, the Cincinnati Commercial. And he was observing how the workers were digging up the foundation for this building. And here's his description. He said, "This rich yellow soil, fat with the human flesh and bone and brain it has devoured, is being disemboweled by 100 spades and forced to exhibit its ghastly secrets to the sun." He says, "You will behold, mingled with piles of skulls, loose vertebra, fibulas, tibias, and the great curving bones of the thigh. All are yellow, like the cannibal clay which denuded them of their fleshly masks. Bone after bone is turned over with a scientific application of kicks. Dirty fingers are poked into empty eye sockets, ribs cracked to reckless feet, and tobacco juice is carelessly squirted among the decaying skulls." And here's my favorite line. "By night there come medical students to steal the poor skulls." So this is how human remains were being treated as this place was being built. Now, some of you probably know a theory about sort of disrespecting human remains and kicking skulls around and spitting tobacco juice on them, et cetera, is not good. That, you know, spirits kind of resent that sort of treatment, which may have something to do with what's going on in Cincinnati Music Hall, which is this. There's a couple things. The obvious thing is people hear music. Well, of course, it's a music hall. But they hear it at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when there's nobody there. Security guards will tell you that it's a big, big complex. There's one main performance area, but there's a lot of other sort of smaller areas for different kinds of sort of smaller recitals. There's meeting areas, so it's a big complex. And I talked to one security guard who told me that she frequently has heard music, like coming from one section of the building. And so she'll go over there to see what's going on. And, you know, maybe somebody's there. It could be somebody's practicing at 3 o'clock in the morning. It shouldn't be, but maybe it's possible. And when she goes over there, she won't hear it anymore. Now she'll hear it over there. She goes over there, and that'll stop. And then she'll hear it over there. Keep tracking it down, and you never get to the source of it. So that's one thing that happens. Another thing that happens is people frequently will see people from around the time of the late 1800s as well. They'll see them in Victorian clothing, like coming down some of the stairs. Frequently when they're performing like an opera or something like that, somebody will be counting the cast members. Let's see, there should be 10 guys in the back. Who's that 11th spear carrier? You know, suddenly there's an extra person in the cast and then he's gone. So those kinds of things happen as well. We think, you know, the spirit's coming back to perform, the spirit's coming to watch concerts, you know, we don't know. Very interesting thing happened. There was a security guard named John Eng. And his story is, he actually wrote down the journal, and he kept a diary of this, and I have a copy of photocopy of his diary. What happened was, he was working one night, there was a private event being catered up there, and he was escorting the caterers down to their truck, It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, they were women, they were loading their stuff onto the truck. As they're going down the elevator, they hear music. Now everybody hears, John, the security guy, hears it, as well as the caterers. That's odd. So he leads them out to the truck, they get in their truck, they take off, he gets back in the elevator, he hears this music again. So he's obviously interested, like, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, there's nobody else in the building, the caterer's gone, I'm here by myself, and I'm hearing music. And he recognizes it. He recognizes the tune as Let Me Call You Sweetheart, you know, that old tune. And he says to me, he didn't say to me, but in his journal, he said that it sounded sort of like a music box kind of, like sort of a tinny kind of sound, an old-fashioned kind of sound. So in his journal, he describes how he rode the elevator up and down, getting off at every floor and exploring to try to find the source of this music, and he never could find it. So he said that in his journal that for weeks he wouldn't go near the elevator because he was just afraid of this. You know, there's something going on. There's music coming out here, and it shouldn't. But then he started thinking that, you know. He started taking it personally, and he started taking it as like a personal sign to him that things go on after death, and look, it's music, and it's Let Me Call You Sweetheart. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And he was a guy, it turned out, who had some illness, and a serious illness, so death was sort of on his mind. And just before, let me see, I've got his quote here too, from his journal, so I'll just read that to you. Just before he passed away, his final entry in the journal, at least about, you know, the elevator music, was this. Well, first of all, what he said was about going near it. He said, for nearly 2 weeks, I could not approach the elevator shaft on the first floor late at night without my whole body tingling. So then he said, just before his death, the experience now, all positive, and will be forever, I now believe. I pray more intensely, don't fear death, and I'm glad to have had this profound experience. Which is kind of a nice way of looking at a ghost haunting. That, wow, I learned something from it. It was kind of a company thing. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But since that music hall, they swear it's still, you know, still haunted. A strange fact, this place is huge. It's in downtown Cincinnati. There are no rats or mice in the building. Now, there used to be rats or mice in the building. There aren't anymore. And that sounds like a weird thing because, I mean, come on, it's in downtown Cincinnati, there's rats. I know there's rats. You gotta be in this building. Well, the facilities manager had a theory. At one time there was a circus that performed here. And apparently, a boa constrictor and a python escaped from the circus. Had never been found in Cincinnati Music Hall. There are no rats in Cincinnati Music Hall. That's all I'm gonna say. The Netherland Hilton downtown in Cincinnati is a very interesting place. This was built in the late 20s. A beautiful, beautiful place. It's all Art Deco. This, what you're looking at, is called the Hall of Mirrors, and it's one of their main sort of ballrooms. All these alcoves are all mirrored glass all around. So if you're standing there, you know, you're seeing a lot of ghosts, because every time you turn around, you're seeing somebody. It's just like you, as a matter of fact. So it's interesting. But they have a ghost they call the Lady in Green. And the hotel, even in its own brochure, talking about their history and their Art Deco and their architecture, they mention the ghost. They say, oh yeah, by the way, we have a lady in green called the ghost. A ghost called Lady in Green. The story behind her is that when this place was being built, her husband was one of the workers that was inside doing some work. And not in this room, but in the restaurant called the Palm Court And the ceilings, it's a two-story high building. Apparently he was working on a scaffold or something and fell, was killed. So he died during construction. The story is that when the hotel opened, had its grand opening, that she bought a beautiful green gown, that she went to the hotel sort of in memory of her husband, that she booked a room in the hotel in memory of her husband, and that she jumped out a window in memory of her husband. That's the story. Nobody knows for sure if that's true. They haven't been able to really authenticate how this happened. But what they do know is that people do see a lady in green frequently. What they usually see is on the elevator. I talked to a server whose story was this. He got on the elevator with a cart. He was taking it upstairs someplace. The elevator was empty. The door closes, and as they start to rise, somebody says something. And he turns around, and there's a lady in green standing. He got off at the very next stop as quick as he could. I mean, said just for a second, then she disappeared. That's happened to other people. They've gotten on a supposedly empty elevator, and somebody taps you on the shoulder, and you turn, and there's a lady in green there. They like to talk about, the staff tells you about a businessman who stayed there one night. He came running down to the lobby, apparently in his underwear and socks. I mean, I find this to be a hard story to believe, but that's what I'm told by the people at the hotel. That was so terrified by what he saw in his room, which he could not explain, that he just left. They put up at another hotel. So Lady in Green is apparently still wandering around there. And I don't know what to make of it, but the hotel is fine about admitting it. Not too far from here, Columbus, this is the Kelton House, which was built around 1840, 1850, I believe, something like that. The last two people who lived there were the Kelton sisters. Grace Kelton, I think is her name, was actually the last person to live in this house. She died in her 90s, I think in 1980 at some point. Grace Kelton was a designer, a fashion designer. She actually helped Jacqueline Kennedy when she was in the White House. She actually helped to do some design work in the White House. So she was very well known, flamboyant. She, in her 90s, she dyed her hair flaming red. She wore red clothes, red shoes, drove a red Cadillac. So people knew Miss Kelton when they saw her in town. The house is open to the public now. She left it to the city, to the Historical Society. You can go and you can look at this house, see all the furnishings. And apparently Grace is still there, according to the people that live there. They've had the typical things of objects moving and being misplaced and that kind of thing. Footsteps, doors opening, closing, all the typical ghost stuff. But one thing they have is they have a little cradle, a miniature cradle for kids to play with. There's two little dolls in there. And the dolls will be put down, lying on their back. And 2 minutes later, look, and the dolls are turned over, or they're moved around, or the whole cradle's been turned around, different direction. And that'll happen within like 5 minutes of putting it away. It just seems to do it itself. They have some of these old, they're not the trollas, but they're, maybe somebody knows the word for them. They're like huge, huge music boxes. They stand this high. They have like a big metal wheel, and you crank it, and then the wheel just turns around. It's got a little spikes, like a music box where it hits different things and it plays.
It's a phonograph, isn't it?
It might be. I don't know, like an old type? Yeah, I guess it maybe still phonograph. But it's beautiful sound, these things. However, they have one that plays all by itself. Now, you've got, this crank is a big iron crank. You've got to crank it, you know? And they'll have it up there, and maybe the last time they played it was a day ago, so the handle has been fully released, and it'll just start playing all by itself. So they have that kind of thing going on. They've seen Grace in the house. So yeah, we've seen a lady in red, sitting in her bedroom and everything else like that. So that's an interesting place to take a look at as well. One of my favorite places. How am I doing on time here? Anybody just checked? Whoa. You guys didn't. No one yelled, shut up. Well, too late now. I'm not going to shut up. Well, I'll tell you about this place. We're getting to the end. The Ridges in Athens is incredible. This is now part of Ohio University. I taught at the university for the last several years before I came to Cincinnati. This place used to be the Athens Mental Asylum, and it's now part of the university, which is so appropriate. I think of my students and I say, yeah, it's appropriate. Mental Asylum, university. No problem. Most of this building is closed up because of safety. It was asbestos and lead and all that kind of stuff. But the bottom level is a museum, art museum, if you want to take a look. People have seen apparitions in here, full-bodied apparitions of patients. They've heard sounds. A friend of mine was an art instructor. On one of the floors, I think it's this one right here, this tower area and part of this floor has been renovated. And fine art instructors have their private studios there, so they can work there. And they have keys, so they can be there 24/7. In the middle of the night, they'll talk about seeing things out of the corner of their eye, something going past the door of their studio. A friend of mine who's an instructor there said he got out of his studio, he was going down the hall to the men's room. He walked into the doorway of the men's room. There's only one door in, and it's a rectangular room. The door is sort of at one end. When you walk in, you're looking at a bank of mirrors over the sinks. So obviously, as soon as you look in at the mirrors, you can see anybody else that's in that room. So as he gets in the doorway, he notices there's a man reflected in the mirror. And it's not him. The guy's wearing a jacket. He has a hat. So he's a little nervous because he thought he was in the place by himself. But he's also not thinking anything unusual. Okay, so there's a guy here. I don't know who it is, but big deal. He walks in. There's nobody there. I mean, there is no other person in that room. And he is standing in the only doorway in and out. So somehow this guy disappeared. I did an investigation here with a group out of Columbus. And we recorded some really interesting EVPs in the basement. The basement is where they used to lock up the patients that were really sort of hardcore, in danger of hurting themselves or others. And so it was like a prison for the most part for those patients. And we got some EVPs. One very clearly says, "Help me, please," coming out of there. So interesting. There's another nice little thing about this place that is not so much paranormal. You can't see it too well. I guess you can. In its heyday, there was about 1,500 to 1,800 patients here. 1873 is when it was built, so it was very popular in those days. But right up into the 1980s, there were still patients. A small group of maybe a dozen hardcore patients that couldn't yet be put out into the community, no place to put them, so they stayed there until they, you know, passed away. They used to take a census every day, morning and evening, I think midday, to make sure everybody's still here. Well, one day in the 80s, they took a census, and a particular woman was missing, was gone. They couldn't find her. They looked all over the floor for her, all over the hospital. They couldn't find her. Long story short, about 3 months later, if you recall those towers that you saw before in that picture, they found her lying in one of these tower rooms on her back, arms crossed like this. Her clothes are all neatly folded alongside of her, like she'd just taken off her clothes, decided that's it, laying down and would die. She basically died, as near as they can figure, of exposure and possibly a heart attack. But the interesting thing is, when they picked up her body, her image was left on the floor. And you can clearly, you can clearly see it. Think head, shoulders, the elbows were, waist, skirt, the whole bit, legs. There's a lot of reasons why this may have happened. She was lying there for a few months in a room that had a lot of sunlight, a lot of windows. We tend to turn to goo at some point. I think that's what was happening. That's the medical term, by the way. And I think that's what, you know, basically happened to her. But the interesting thing is, that was in the 1980s. This is my picture taken in 2003. And the image is still there. And the legend, of course, is that it can never be erased. Well, I don't think anybody's actually tried. There's no point. It's a locked floor. It's an abandoned ward. But it's just kind of a neat little story. The other thing, too, is my students used to tell me, they say, "You know, Mr. Kachuba, if you touch that image up there, if you get up there and you touch that image, you're going to die." I said, "You know what? You're going to die anyway." Okay, I'm just going to skip this. This is not that important. I want to get to just the end because I know those of you are coming on. I just want to say that there's a couple things going on. The first book was Ghost Hunting Ohio for me and Ghost Hunting Illinois, but I'm also serving as an editor for Clarice Press, who's doing a series of books called America's Haunted Road Trip. And each one is about a different state. So we already have New Jersey and Virginia in the lineup. This fall we'll have Maryland, Texas, Pennsylvania. So if you have a favorite state, you know, next year we're doing New York City, Florida, Southern California, all different writers, not me. We're getting some top writers to write these books. And then that's my own website too, if you're interested in anything that I'm doing. So I do want to just take a few minutes for questions. I know we have somebody coming on at 11:30, and I apologize for that. But are there any questions or comments, or anybody want to throw anything? Yes.
Are you going to be doing Michigan soon?
I have a lineup now for next year and for 2011. But Michigan is a state we want to do very soon, so I'm thinking maybe 2012, which in the publishing world is very soon. It's only 3 years away. Michigan, Wisconsin, probably those areas, because it's a big population. So. Any questions? Yes?
We were just skipping Collingwood Arts Center. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
All right, I will. Just briefly. Collingwood Arts Center, Let me go back to this. Is a it's up in Toledo, and it used to be a Catholic school run by Ursuline nuns. It is now an art center where artists actually live there, and all kinds of artists, performing artists, you know, sculptures, visual, whatever. They live here and they perform their art. A friend of mine told me that she had some impressions. She was a medium, and she had some impressions that there was something going on there. So I went to check it out. And without saying anything, I just told the director that I was writing a book, and I heard something about this. And he said, OK, I just want to look around. He said, fine, do that. I went down to the basement area, which is a urinal, halls, and different kinds of rooms. This was a pretty big complex. And as I was walking down there through a dark passage, the air just sort of suddenly, in one passage as I'm walking, kind of got, for lack of a better word, thick. It felt heavy all of a sudden, like dense. It's kind of strange. And it suddenly got very quiet, too, as if I was walking into something. And at the same time, I also got like this immediate sense of, not anxiety, but sort of sadness, like depression. And some of you know me, those of you that don't, I'm not a depressive kind of guy, trust me. So I kept walking, like another 5 feet, and then boom, everything was gone. All that just lifted. I was still in the dark, still by myself, but all those feelings were gone, that heaviness was gone. So I basically just stopped and said, what was that? I went back upstairs, I was talking to some of the artists that were there, and they proceeded to tell me that they have something in the basement called Shadow Man. And they said, a couple of artists have had the thing where Shadow Man has literally been on the stairs and come right up, literally blown through them, as they say. They describe Shadow Man as a black silhouette, featureless silhouette. So I asked one of the artists, where did you experience that in the basement? And we went back down to the basement, and you'll probably guess what I'm going to say. One of the areas they saw it a lot was where I had this experience. Now, did I see Shadow Man? No. But I certainly felt something. The story is that after I left, about 2 weeks after I left, the art director at the place called me and said, you know, we had some visitors. And he said some elderly women came, and they said that they were retired nuns, Ursuline nuns, who used to teach at this place and was a school. And they wanted to take a tour because he had heard about how the place had revitalized itself, and you know, they're happy to see that. So he said, yeah, I gave them a little tour, I showed them all around. He said, as I was leading them out, as they were saying goodbye, one of them turned around to me and she said, by the way, she said, is the shadow still in the basement? And he said, I hadn't said anything. And there was nothing in the newspapers or anything else. As far as I know, I'm the first person to have written about it. So he said, that really surprised. And he said, well, people have seen something. And they explained what it was. They said that one of their fellow nuns, a young nun, very early, had actually committed suicide in the basement, that she hanged herself. And they said, you know, we know who it is. When we were there, she was still there in spirit. We knew who she was. But we still were very afraid to go down there and, you know, deal with it. So that's the, and Collingwood, it's still, there's a lot of other things that happen there too. People experience doors opening, closing, objects moving, all that kind of stuff. But, so. Okay, yes?
Do you have any plans on building military ships in the future?
We've got a couple in some of the other books. Like there's one about Maryland, and they have, I think, the Constellation that's in Baltimore Harbor. Somebody that's doing a book about Texas has a ship, I don't know if it's the Galveston or something like that, but if I would not do a book just about ships, but certainly I'm going to be doing another Ohio, you know, book, so if there's a ship somewhere up in Lake Erie or something, a historic ship, yeah, definitely. In my Chicago book, my Illinois book rather, I wrote about the Chicago Museum of Natural Science, or Science and Industry, has a captured German U-boat from World War II. And the captain actually committed suicide in that boat, shot himself during a bombardment. So I wrote about that. So yeah, and I certainly do if I see the opportunity, definitely. Do you have something in mind?
Well, we were on the Lady Lex, and my wife experienced a very hard feeling on it. She said it felt like a freezer, somebody opened up a freezer in the middle of the Lady
Lex. Oh, really?
And considering it's not air conditioned, that would be, it's not about 90 degrees, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of haunted ships, yeah. I mean, if they're within one of the states that we're doing, take a look at it. But, all right, any other questions? Or?
Yes. I was wondering if you've ever been up to Power House in Akron.
Power House, yeah.
Howard House was it's a big mansion that's now part of the University of Akron's campus.
Okay.
And my brother-in-law told me a story. He was a maintenance man for the university. And the Howards were a very influential family in Akron for a lot of years. And the last occupant was the woman. I don't know what her name was. But he and an associate were called in to do some work on the water heater that was in the house. The house was totally locked up. It was filled with antiques, so it was completely locked up so no one could get in. They were issued a key, told to unlock the door, go in, lock the door behind them, all that. So they're down in the basement working on the water heater, and a woman's voice, very clearly that they could hear, kept asking them, "Hello? Hello, hello." And finally, you know, my brother-in-law he's a very cool guy. I mean, he's a Vietnam vet, and he very calmly says, "Hi, we're the maintenance people. We're here to fix your water heater." And after that, the voice stopped saying hello. But they were called back later that afternoon because the water had been turned on in the bathtub. And it had been turned on to perfect bath temperature, two faucets had been turned on, and no one had been in the house. But apparently, Mrs. Howard is still there.
Taking a bath, too. That's why she's saying hello, I'm taking a bath here.
I don't know if that's, I would assume that the university probably doesn't open that up to the public, but that's
really
interesting place.
They might, I don't know. I mean, it's. I try to write about things that the public can go to, you know, to encourage them to do that. And there are some places that, yeah, you can't do it. But I don't know. I didn't know about that. I will check into it. All right, well, I know we have somebody coming up soon, so I'm going to have to cut it here. I do have a booth out here, so if you have other questions or just want to come by and talk, certainly feel free. I mean, but I think we have to conclude now. So I appreciate your patience and your diligence so early in the morning for the first go-round. So thanks very much.